Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to North and South Podcasts. I've got two fantastic guests on this week, and I was put in contact with these two comedians by Matt Jones, who is a comedian from Liverpool, and he was on a few months ago with Claire Berry, and it was Claire Berry's actually been on three times, but it was her second time coming on to talk about her experiences of ADHD, but also comedy, because she's in the comedy world and she does a fantastic night called Femme de la Femme in Liverpool. And I've shared details about Femme de la Femme in the past. Check it out. Matt Jones is also on the comedy circuit, and he said to me, you need to speak to these two people, Amy and Emerson. So that's Amy Egerling and Emerson Young, who have kindly agreed to give up their time today. They're both in various parts of the country using technology to be here with us today. So apologies if there's slight delays. I'm just really happy to have them on the podcast. So I've heard studies saying that comedians are more likely to have issues with well-being and or neurodiversity. And that was something that I discussed with Claire Berry and Matt Jones on a previous podcast. And I'm just so pleased to get Amy and Emerson on today to tell us their stories about well-being and neurodiversity, and also to do with their lives in comedy. So, Amy, first, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Absolutely. So I am Amy Egerling. I am a mum of two boys. I run a non-profit, and I also do stand-up comedy.
Excellent. And Emerson, do you want to introduce yourself?
My name's Emerson Young, and sort of clinging on to being a student by a thread, 23 years old, from Sheffield, live in Liverpool, and I do stand-up comedy.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, folks. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to have a chat about well-being, neurodiversity, and comedy. So, Amy, do you want to tell us your kind of story of where you've been, how you got into comedy, and what you've discovered about yourself so far in your life in relation to well-being and neurodivergence?
Yeah, definitely. So I actually started comedy through the Comedy Trust in Liverpool, and I did a well-being course, and it was called Funny Mums, and it was for any mum who, they also have a Funny Dads version, and anybody who has struggled with mental health in the past or currently struggling with it, etc., but was looking for a different creative outlet. So there's lots of studies about how laughter, comedy can be a creative outlet that can support people's well-being, and I'm fascinated by this. So I live in North Wales, so I saw this through work, and so everyone thought I was mad because I was driving an hour every week to go to this comedy course. But I was surrounded by the most amazing creative people. I was supported by incredible Katie Tracy, who is an amazing pro comic, was sort of the main mentor, and she taught me so much in that time. Now, I did it as kind of a bucket list thing, but I loved it so much, and the comedy scene has been so supportive and so encouraging that I've just kind of carried it on. But when I did the wellbeing course, I believed that I struggled with depression. I'd had postnatal depression with both my kids, and for a long time I thought I had bipolar because my emotions are very up and down and things, but I never kind of quite knew what was wrong with me. So this year, actually, what's happened is I had a bit of a breakdown in January. So I had my longest best friend, literally met her the day she was born. We had a massive fallout, huge fallout. And that kind of sent me spiraling. I was very low. I felt like I had nothing to live for. And it wasn't her fault in any way. She was just the trigger to me exploding, I think. Lots of things going on. And then really randomly, I was watching TV and something came up about emotionally unstable personality disorder. And I was watching it, and it was a documentary. And I was like, that's me. That's me. So my mum very kindly paid for me to go private. because the waiting list for an NHS assessment is about 2 years where I live. So we paid to go private. And so 3 weeks later, I had an assessment. And the assessments, this was back in February. The assessment was so thorough. She got me to tell her things I've never told anybody in my entire life. And at the end of it, she said, I can strongly believe that you have emotionally unstable personality disorder. So I'll explain what that is for everybody, if that's okay. So emotionally unstable personality disorder, which I'll call EUPD because it's easier, is also known as borderline personality disorder. So it's the same wording. I prefer emotionally unstable personality disorder because I think it explains it a bit better. And I think with any mental health and well-being, the more people know, the better it is. So essentially, the easiest way to describe it is for a neurotypical person or a person that doesn't struggle with emotions, when they experience an emotion, it's like walking into a shop and hearing a familiar song in the background.
Mm.
When I experience an emotion, it's like standing between two massive speakers that are like a metal concert. So when I'm sad, I want to kill myself. This is extreme, but this is how it is. When I'm sad, I feel like I just want to end everything. When I'm angry, it can get to the point of, it's like, I'm ready to kill somebody. It's that strong. And then when I'm happy, it's kind of a bit manic.
Mm.
And what I really struggle with is that normal, okay, good, stable, nice life. The best way to describe when I'm in that zone, I feel uncomfortable. I feel like I'm moving my body. For those that, obviously, you're just hearing me, but you can't see me. I feel itchy and I struggle. And then what happens is I will divulge in a not very good behavior, I'll excessively drink. I will, this is not a secret in my family and stuff. So my husband and I are separated. Our relationship broke down 2 years ago. We were together 19 years. I'm quite happy to talk about this. It's not an issue, but we're very close. We co-parent really well, but I kind of always pushed him away and I've cheated on him. Sexually impulsive behavior is a trait, and essentially I always just thought I was an idiot. Are we allowed to swear?
If you want to say a swear word now, just because it helps you to describe it, I might edit it out later or I might leave it in, so feel free to.
So I just thought for a long time I was depressed and that I was also just a dickhead.
Yeah,
was the best way to describe it. It's just that I was just making poor choices. I wasn't a good human being and all that stuff. So Matt Jones actually asked me, and Emerson was in the car when he asked me, he was asking us both about labels.
Mm.
And, you know, do we think they're important? And I think labels are important to somebody if they feel they're important. But now that I've been labelled with this condition, everything makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's been a real life-changing thing for me. Mm. Massively. So I'm reading tons on it now. I'm hoping to have, it's called dialectal behavioral therapy. So it's a bit like CBT, but it's a bit gentler, and it's more long term.
Right. So cognitive behavioral therapy is fairly well known in counseling circles, and that's the idea of tackling thoughts and tackling behaviors. And the idea is it's kind of like, let's do this now, kind of in the present kind of thing. So you're talking about dialectical behavior therapy.
That's the one.
Do you want to just tell us briefly what that is? I know you said it's more long term. Do you know anything else about it at this stage? And feel free not to answer that if you don't want it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Not massively. So I know it's more about being kind to yourself. It's a lot more forgiving, but it's pinpointing the triggers and how your behavior reacts to that. There's a lot of group therapy work with it, I believe, but that's probably, you probably know more than me, which would be great.
Yeah, no, I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of that particular type of therapy, and it doesn't come under the main umbrellas of what the main parts of like counselling is. Like, I've done a level two counselling course, but the idea that there's one type of counselling or two or three types that like just, oh, you're either that one or that one, it's far more complicated than that. And depending on your conditions, there's things now to do with cognitive analytical therapy, which is a bit more long-term and thinking about the whys behind things. And dialectical sounds like you're looking at two different options and looking at which way you go, you're examining triggers, and it seems to be more holistic and long-term. But if you've got a particular condition, that's what's needed. And it's about finding the best way for you. I mean, I've had great help with CBD through the year, CBT. Sorry, that was a Freudian slip. Yeah, I might edit that out. CBT.
CBT. I love CBT.
Yeah,
that's another story. Although it's legal now, isn't it? So I've had some joy with CBT, but also CBT only goes so far, and sometimes you need different methods that look at the more holistically, that look at your past, that look at like bigger and deeper issues than that. So it'd be interesting to hear more about that in the future, maybe when you've had more experience of it, if that was okay. But I mean, I relate to a lot of what you said, and I was literally talking about UPD and BPD and bipolar disorder this week in terms of emotional regulation. And I think I struggle with my emotions, and I think that what you've described is similar to a lot of what I've experienced, Amy. And I've been listening to a podcast called the Adult ADHD Podcast, and 90% of my behavior has been explained through that podcast. And I found it so liberating to go, oh my goodness, I've been thinking I'm a wrong'un, there's something wrong with me all my life. And then at the age of 45 or 44, maybe when I started listening to it, because I've got these other things like depression, anxiety, and that. And then all of a sudden, ADHD was like, right, here's what ADHD is like. And I've taught kids with ADHD for years and think, oh, I haven't got ADHD. But it's not about in-your-face stuff a lot of the time. And you often don't see things that are hidden in plain sight. And you don't have the frames of reference. And you can't always turn the focus around on yourself. It's hard because you're going through life and life's so complicated. And I found labels useful. But as you say, I've had this discussion with Matt as well, they shouldn't limit you. The label shouldn't limit you, but it can help you to understand yourself. Because ultimately, you're Amy Eggerling.
Yeah.
Tim, Emerson, Emerson. Even our names are created anyway, so we're not actually those things. But the experiences that we are all unique, but there are things that can help point you in the right direction and can help you to explain your life and make you feel better. And I think that's why labels can be useful, but they shouldn't be restrictive. And I think that you've explained that really, really well.
Oh, no, I completely agree with that. And I don't need to. So, for example, I was at a wedding with a friend of mine at the weekend, and someone said, oh, this is Abby. And then a few minutes later, they were like, oh, she's gay. And she's like, thanks for outing me. She was like, you didn't need to say that. You know, I'm Abby.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. That's all you need to say. So, yeah, I think I'm still me.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely still me. And one thing you just said then about the different therapies and stuff, I think when I first got diagnosed, I went through like a grieving process. So I was really angry because I have been to the GP, I have been to Mind, I have been to, so in Wales, we have something called Parabol, which uses Mind and things. So it's like that intervention when you're not so bad, you need primary care services. It's that interim sort of support where they can give you counselling or online things and whatever. And I've been to all these. I've done CBT. I've done a mindfulness course. I have done counselling. And they've been a bit of a band-aid. And things have been okay for a little bit. But because nobody's really got to the core of what's up with me. So I'm 40 next year. So I've gone through this process of when I first got diagnosed, being really angry with the system.
Yeah.
I'm really upset because a lot of things I'm reading online and stuff, it's about, you know, if you can diagnose it earlier in the 20s, or I've had it definitely, without a doubt, since I was a teenager, like my high school years, the lot. And I just think if it had been recognized when I first got diagnosed with depression at 21, if things had been more picked up, and I don't doubt I did have depression at 21, I did, but I don't believe, I think I can struggle with depression and I can have depressive bouts in my life, but generally I'm not depressed. I have irregulated moods, but I'm over that now. And I think it's an important thing for people to recognize as well. I'm a true believer in life is hard. Things happen in life that we can't control, and it's horrible. But I believe that, you know, I try and sit and live with my emotions, but then get past them. So I don't want to hold on to that anger. There's nothing I can do about that. That's not going to do me any good. That's not going to do my kids, you know, being mum to my kids any good. None of that stuff. I'm not going to live a well, healthy life by holding on to that anger. Now I know what's up with me. I can seek the right help. I can do things like this and, you know, spread a bit more awareness. I think my biggest fear when I tell people I've got EUPD, or I say BPT, BP, borderline personality disorder, I think people are going to think I'm like the woman off, like someone off Fatal Attraction, and I'm going to be like murdering people and stuff. I'm like, I'm not that crazy. I'm not going to be like, you know, I'm not going to be like setting fire to your gardens. I'm not that unstable. So I think it's really important that there's lots of people that can live quite normal lives. But I mask it, I suppose. Emerson might talk about this a little bit. You know, I think a lot of people with different neurodiversions, they mask things to fit in. And that's it's a bit sad, really.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff there that, you know, we could go back and pick up on. But I think it is sad that people feel that they need to mask. And I was reading recently a book called, it was a book about disability, and it was talking about the social model of disability analysis, whereby the problem isn't with the individuals who are disabled or who are different. The problem is with the society that kind of tries to straitjacket people. And that might sound quite utopian, but at the end of the day, it's absolutely spot on. Because if you think about very early societies where there was 150 of us living in a group or whatever, then people had different strengths and weaknesses. And you'd go, right, okay, you do this, you do that. Da, 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 da. Now we force people through the same education system for everyone, regardless of your needs and what your mind is like and how your brain works. And we say to everyone, though, the way to success is to get your own house and to have children and to get married and to pay your taxes and to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if you don't do that, then there's something wrong with you, kind of thing. And I'm not making out that there was some kind of utopian in them very early human societies, but this idea that you have to be a particular way, and it's 10 times better now than when I was in my 20s and when I was young. I mean, what you said there is people still have a thing about, oh, yeah, depression, anxiety, people get that now. As soon as you hear the word personality disorder, it's like, whoa, this person goes into different like mental states and goes around like, you know, strangling cats and stuff. There's still an aspect of that, isn't there? When you mentioned the more personality-based disorders that maybe involve psychosis, etc. When in fact, these people are out there and they're doing okay. And we need to be more open and to discuss these things. And I think that you've explained that perfectly there through your experiences. I just want to go back because when you got privately assessed, what did you get privately assessed for? Was it for just a general mental health assessment? How did you approach that? Because I'm waiting to be assessed for ADHD at the minute, and there's a bit of a waiting list. So, how did you approach getting assistance?
So I contacted them and I said that I have had a bad spout, sort of a breakdown, I'm quite mentally unwell at the moment. I believe that I've got there's something else going on, not just depression. I have read some things about BPD, EUPD, and they sound similar, but I don't know. And then so she took it, she asked me a billion different things, but she it was a full mental health assessment really of my mood, everything. So she considered everything before she gave me the diagnosis.
Right, so that's important. You had some idea that there might be something, but it was a general analysis. So if someone went to the GP and got referred to a mental health specialist or whatever, they would go and have an initial assessment that looked at a broad range of things to see if your suspicions were right or it might lead down a different path. And that's how you can be identified in that
It is, but I
regard.
went down that path about 10 years ago, and I remember, and I don't believe everyone has this experience, and unfortunately, it is a little bit of a lottery, isn't it? And I remember going to my for one of these initial assessments, and because I was questioning, I did a bipolar at the time, and I walked in, and I remember clear as day, the psychiatrist, he laughed at me. He laughed. He did like a scoff laugh, and he says, "No, you don't have bipolar. You're just depressed." And that was it. That and then obviously is extra trauma on me and everything else, and that's really, really stuck with me. And I know the system's underfunded, and I know the system's broken. And that's not why I went private. I went private because I'm fortunate enough that my parents could pay for that for me, and they were in the position they could afford to do that. I'm happy to say the amount it was actually it was £425 for the assessment, and I found the experience really good in the fact of it wasn't hard sell for future stuff, and because I live in Wales, I get my prescriptions for free, so she's recommended a new medication for me, and she's and they could have done it through them for £30, but she went, "Don't go through us if you can get it through your GP." She was like, "You need to go to your GP first," but again, I think you can go private and not get the best experience either. It's
So, Emerson, I'm going to come across to you now. Just spoken to Amy about her journey up to where she is now. But basically, what's been your journey to understanding your own kind of neurodivergence and well-being? How have you got to the stage where you're at now?
well, it's I think my kind of pathway to understand and my own brain and my own neurodivergence has been a bit different in terms of like timelines to Amy's because I was diagnosed as autistic when I was 7. So obviously I've had quite a long time to come to terms with that. And I had support that I wouldn't otherwise have got if I'd not been diagnosed that early. I was diagnosed as dyspraxic quite a lot more recently. Like I knew I had coordination issues. I had physiotherapy for coordination issues, but they just sort of tacked DCD onto me autism diagnosis. So the actual developmental coordination disorder or dyspraxia diagnosis that I've got that actually helps me to get accommodations and education and whatever, I actually got that a bit later. I found that there was support I could access at uni that I needed a dyspraxia diagnosis for, not just the autism diagnosis. So I got the dyspraxia diagnosis and
Just on university, how difficult has it been for you in terms of adapting to university with that kind of, it's very independent and the idea is, you're supporting yourself. Have you found that quite a challenge over the last few years?
I can't really say much for how it could have been because I went to uni in 20. Well, I did a foundation year, but my actual course started in 2019, and we all know what happened to the remainder of that academic year. So I think I struggled a lot more than I would have done with isolation and struggling to keep myself motivated and I think it would have been a lot less of a struggle if I'd been going in and doing in-person classes, because I struggle to, if I'm in my room all the time, my bed's there, my computer's there, everything I do is there, I eat there, I sleep there, that for me it's really important to have a divide between where you work and where your life is. And obviously all the concerns that came with COVID, like anxiety and depression, and things that exacerbated existing anxiety, depression, and the lack of support as well. So I can't say how uni would have been if COVID hadn't been a thing, but I did struggle with uni, and I think it were down to a number of factors.
The impact of COVID. I mean, I found personally the first COVID lockdown was nice weather and stuff, and I was at home with my family, and I had a nice garden and at a park at the end of the street. I was very lucky, but it's only now I realise the impact that COVID's had on me, and I think for many years to come, I think it's going to be like the impact of World War II on people. You had like kids who hadn't gone to school for 5 years, and people who've been living in fear for 5 years. And I think the impact of COVID has just made everything harder for everyone. And particularly if you're already experiencing issues, even in ways that are quite subtle and are hard to explain, it makes that all the more difficult. And I remember the pictures of students literally being locked in halls, like holding, writing up in the window saying, like, please help us and all this, because of the isolation. It must have been very, very difficult. And also there was people who finished uni and whole academic years without any human contact. I mean, it's just not natural. It's very, very strange. But
Aye.
do you find that your autism and dyspraxia diagnosis, do you find that the things are put in place to help you are adequate enough, or do you think that they could be better? And I'm not just talking about university, I'm just talking about life generally.
I mean, it obviously it could be better. Everything could be
Yeah.
better. I think I've got better at adapting to a world that often doesn't feel like it's very welcoming to me. Like, I've got better at just kind of putting up with stuff. But also over recent, as I've got older and as I've sort of got more familiar with how my brain works and the fact that, because you as a kid, well-meaning people say you can do anything you want despite your diagnosis. You can be anything, you can do anything, you shouldn't let it stop you. And that's, I don't know, I think the idea that a diagnosis having an impact on your life means that you must be suffering and that things must be bad, I think that's misguided. I think it's fine to step back and say, actually, I can't do this, or if I do this, it's going to have a negative impact on my mental health, maybe more, or physical health even, maybe more so than it would for somebody else. So because of my neurodivergence, disabilities, whatever else, I'm not going to put myself through this because I know I can't do it, and I'm not going to destroy myself trying, and that's fine. I think that's an underrated sentiment.
I read an article the other day about how a lot of disability rights have been kind of, chipped away at in recent years since the Equalities Act in, was it 2010, which was a huge leap forward, the Equalities Act. But things have been getting chipped away gradually. Funding's being cut to the front line. And I've often felt that myself, Emerson, and I think you put that brilliantly there, this idea that you can be anything. But by the way, there's 100 hurdles to get over, and let's give you an extra 20 hurdles to get over. It's all very well saying that, but you've often faced with the real world, and I think you've described it brilliantly there. And I got quite emotional actually when you said you've kind of got used to the fact that the world doesn't really want you the way you are. And to hear that, we all know it's true because that's how the world works, but I just think that's sad. That is how the world works. As much as we say, like, oh yeah, we've made huge strides forward, over the last few generations. I think that's just a sad thing to say, because it's true. And I think we as a society can do a lot better, because it's all very well as well saying, oh yeah, you know, I've been speaking to parents recently trying to get like extra support for their children through the school system when they're faced with difficulties, and how difficult that can be. And thinking, well, why is that made so difficult? Because of funding, et cetera, or whatever. I think it's very, very, very sad. Do you find that your autism and dyspraxia, we were talking about labels before, what, Amy, do you find that that has helped equip you with being able to cope? Or do you find that that's limited you? And do you think other people have judged you more by it? And I'll give you an example. Let's imagine someone is struggling in a job and leaves their work because they've got undiagnosed neurodiversity. If that person knew it and said to their colleagues and to their workplace, oh, by the way, I've got this, does that then make their lives easier for them? Is it less likely for them to be moved on from their job or whatever? So do you find that your labels have helped you or hindered you? What's your view on diagnosed with autism and dyspraxia? Do you find that helpful or restrictive, or aspects of both?
I mean, I'd love to say it's clear-cut and they've 100% helped, and it's never been 100%. But I will say it depends on the situation. It depends on the people that you're surrounded with, because I have, in the past, like at school, I were bullied. I mean, I were weird anyway, but I were bullied because people knew that I had special needs.
Yeah.
And called names because kids knew I had special needs. And that potentially wouldn't have happened if I wasn't diagnosed and open about it. But at the same time, in terms of me understanding myself and knowing my strengths and capabilities, and also things that I need a bit more support with, and then also with my friends and them understanding me, I think the labels help. Because there's a reason, so people get their heads around it a bit easier than just, oh yeah, he's a bit weird and he doesn't like loud noises. Like, you know, and again with the dyspraxia, like people take the piss out of me because I trip over or whatever, or because I can't do something in a way that's considered normal. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, my mates do get that there's a reason for it, and they will often try to give me a hand or accommodate that. I mean, like, I was in London a while back with a group of mates, and we were getting the train, and the train stopped on a curve, which meant that there was a massive gap between the train and the platform. And I've got, like, mostly dyspraxia, but also partially I've got a lack of perception because of the way my eyes work. There's no cure for it, so it's just there. So I was struggling to, you know, safely negotiate a path off the train down onto a platform, and my mate just grabbed my hand and just made sure I were all right. Like, if I didn't have people's diagnoses, whatever, if I didn't have those, then they maybe wouldn't, you know, people maybe that I'm close to wouldn't consider the fact that sometimes I need a bit of support with stuff. Like, they maybe wouldn't consider that as much if it didn't have a specific name and a specific reason. I've also got sensory processing issues, and I strongly suspect ADHD as well. So I've got what I like to call a disability sandwich. But, you know, because obviously a lot of it's in the way that my brain works, but manifests, you know, loud noises are often physically painful. And with the sensory processing stuff, it can make it hard for me, well, sensory processing and auditory processing, I guess, because it can make it hard for me to focus in on what I'm meant to be listening to, or what I'm meant to be looking at, and that then makes it hard for me to navigate some, you know, especially like social scenarios, and I have to ask people to repeat themselves because I can't I've not picked out what was said out of all the background noise. And so I think I've basically, over the years, I've come to terms with the fact that, and especially over the last few years, because COVID gave me a lot of time to think about it, obviously, because I was on my own in my flat for weeks on end. I did a lot of introspection. And I found that I've got a lot of stuff going on. It's not just one label. It can't be explained succinctly in a little sentence. It's not all in the dictionary. You can't look up a phrase and read it and understand how my brain works. But that's fine, and that it does have implications for my mental health, and it affects the way my brain works. It affects me physically. In some cases, like the SPD affects me physically, in terms of like body sensations and processing those, and the dyspraxia affects me physically and sometimes quite obviously physically, because it affects the way that I navigate through space and affects the way that I can carry out like day-to-day tasks. And coming to terms with the fact that that is just how I am, and there's not really a lot I can do about it. I think that's helped, to be honest, because it's made me feel less like a defective neurotypical and not non-disabled person, and more like an okay neurodivergent disabled person.
That's very, very powerful and empowering to say that. And again, that fits in a lot with the book I read recently. I think it was called Disability Visibility. And I should really be able to cite it better. It really changed my perspective on things because I would like to get to a world where I can say to people, here's my strengths, here's my weaknesses, and that's okay. And I think that's what you'd like to be able to do, Emerson. And I think that's what Amy would like to be doing. And I think that's the kind of world. And that's not to say you say about your weaknesses, oh, I'm not even looking at that. We can all improve in certain ways and come up with coping mechanisms and stuff. But isn't it powerful to be able to say? I mean, I've taught kids for years who've been I've read on the literature that you've got SPD and dyspraxia. But to hear you describe it then, it makes me understand what it's like. There are things which get on my nerves, which other people don't really understand. And for me to be able to say, listen, that affects me in this way, it's hard for someone else to understand that. But to hear you say it like that, it kind of gives people an understanding of what it must be like when you've got a loud noise that is just dominating your entire consciousness and you want that loud noise to stop and getting off the train because, people do things, don't they? And they get anxious about things. And if you're going around all day anxious that something might happen that you can't really cope with or deal with too well, that affects your self-esteem, doesn't it? And it's being able to talk about these things and to be okay with that. I think that's so important in the modern world. And I think it just goes to show how much further we've got to go, basically. Do you take any medication to manage any of your symptoms of the comorbidities to do with autism, dyspraxia, etc., Emerson?
CBD's all right.
You have found CBD useful to help mitigate some of your symptoms and your anxieties, though. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it can make it just takes the edge off the anxiety a bit, but also the dyspraxia is sort of goes hand in hand with the quite severe for me anyways, it's different for different people obviously, but for me I've got quite severe joint hypermobility, which means I twist my ankles quite easily and I get pain in my knees and elbows and from them bending too much. Like I have to put effort in for my knees to not bend the wrong way. And if they do bend the wrong way, it's quite painful. And no one else is there, well, very few people have stood there consciously attempting to not let their knees turn inside out when they're tired. But I, it's sort of some days are better than others, but it can manifest itself as sort of constant kind of low level sometimes, but occasionally worse, just pain. And I've found, you know, obviously taking medication for the pain helps, because that's one less thing for my brain to be worrying about. But I think that's something that people often don't consider as a part of dyspraxia either, because I've been struggling with it for years. And it wasn't until I got my official dyspraxia diagnosis and she was asking questions about my joints that I realised that it's actually not just a normal part of being human. Like, most people's bodies aren't like mine. And I think it makes me cut myself a bit more slack. Like, if I can't walk around for as long as I'd like to without having a rest, or if I can't stand still in one spot for hours without, you know, being in pain, it is, you know, I try to cut myself a bit more slack now, because I know that there's a reason for it and that I shouldn't have to deal with that if I don't want to. And
so it's about knowing that, yeah, you can take painkillers, certain things are going to be up with you each day, and you can find CBD helpful to manage things, and about being okay with that.
Yeah, CBD takes the edge off. It also helps me sleep. It's difficult as well, because obviously, think, you know, it's a day by day thing. So it is sometimes hard to tell how much of it's the CBD and how much it's just how I am at that moment.
But yeah.
I have found the CBD does often correlate with me sleeping better and being generally in less physical pain, discomfort, whatever. It doesn't treat the actual symptoms of the joints being abnormal, obviously, but it does take the edge off. It's just like, I think people often don't, like I said, they don't think about physical comorbidities of what are considered neurodivergencies, because dyspraxia is a neurodivergency, even though it does have physical effects. You know, it's still considered part of the neurodivergent sort of spectrum. You know, people think, oh, it's just you're a bit clumsy and you fall over. But it's, you know, it is a lot more than that. And I am okay at some physical sort of tasks, or I can do them if I do them slowly. But then that means I've got less time and less energy for other things. Just like, I can do the thing, but it takes more out of me than it might take a non-dyspraxic person.
To hear what you're saying, it gives an idea of what you are dealing with each and every day. And I think people need to know about this, because life's difficult enough, as Amy was saying earlier. You know, life can be very tough.
Emerson, you know I adore you anyway, but everything you've said then is just phenomenal. And it is so blooming important. And I think it was well, yeah, I adore you.
Just again, what Emerson said there, I know people with autism. I know people who think they might be autistic. I know people with ADHD, various types of neurodivergence. But to hear that, I don't think I've ever heard that said like that. Here's what my day is like. And yeah. Emerson was a little bit reluctant to come on, thinking, oh, I haven't got as much to say as Amy. But I think the two of you have said very, very powerful things. Just before we conclude, and we're going to do a part two about how you find comedy helpful, and we'll talk about your non-profit then, Amy. But do you find that the comorbidities are explained for you under the umbrella of EUPD, or do you find that EUPD, it's like a bit of a Venn diagram where overlap with other comorbidities and other things like depression?
Yeah, I completely think it overlaps with everything. And Emerson actually struck a chord with me, saying there is no dictionary definition. So my son is autistic, he's 7. People think, they assume they know my child because of that diagnosis, but it's not. You meet one person with autism, you meet one person with autism. They have, their personalities are thrown in there. and any past trauma that we've all got, any life stresses that are going on. So yeah, I think so much overlaps that feeds into my diagnose, my label, I suppose. So yeah, there's not one size fits all at all.
Yeah. EUPD can cause things like depression, but also you can have depression that goes with the EUPD to make it worse. And that's what I've found. Like, I've had issues with anxiety, depression, but I'm half thinking now, well, is that because of the ADHD and me trying to cope with that? Or no, go
can
on.
I just say one quick thing about my...
Yeah.
So when I had postnatal depression, it was awful. It was really, really awful. The only way I could describe the way I knew I loved my child was thinking of not having him anymore. So thinking about him dying. And me saying that now absolutely crucifies me. Mm. But that's what it was like. But I think because of the UPD, that my postnatal was more severe. But I got the support for the postnatal. So I came out of that postnatal depression. But then that sort of beating myself up part, not low self-esteem, that remained. That never went anywhere. Medication. Do you want to talk about medication?
Yeah. What are you on at the moment to kind of help you?
I'm currently on venlafaxine, and that's what I've taken for depression. I'm a bit...
Is that an antidepressant?
It is a mood stabilizer.
Yeah, mood stabilizer, yeah.
But yeah, it is supporting my depression. The medication that I'm going to be on, and I don't know the wording of it, sorry, but it is an epilepsy thing. Again, it's a mood stabilizer that I've been suggested to go on. Now, what's been recommended is that I take both medications. And with this new medication, she has said to me, I will need to be on it for at least 2 years before we consider taking me off it. But what I liked about her telling me that is no one's ever told me that before. Mm. With medication. It's like, oh, you need to take it. It'll kick in 6 weeks. Off you go. Whereas now I feel like, okay, I've got to give it 2 years.
Mm.
And then I can review it bit by bit. Because ideally, I'd love to not be putting drugs into my body. I'd love to be able to live a life, if I have to, for the rest of my life, to support me. Again, like Emerson was saying, no judgment, that's what I need. But if I can, that would be great.
Well, the medication issue is a whole new kind of worms, because in ADHD, they talk about titration, getting to that correct balance that can take a very long time. With medications you take for mental health, mood stabilization, you can take months and months, and then you're up this and you lower that, and you're up this and you lower that. And it's a very, very difficult path, because when you're feeling low and things aren't quite working or things aren't quite kicking in yet, it can be very difficult. I think it's important for people to hear about that. And I want to talk about medication on future podcasts with people in relation to medication. But listen, Emerson and Amy, I'm going to let you both go. I think we'll talk about the comedy aspect in part two. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the postnatal depression as well, Amy, the difference between that and depression and stuff. And Emerson, if there's anything else you want to mention in the next podcast, we're going to focus on comedy, the postnatal stuff. But if there's anything that you haven't mentioned that you want to mention, just jot it down and we can talk about it then. But I just want to thank you both